Hi, welcome back to Bullet Points. Today I'm going to be speaking with Dr. Suzette Grillo, a Fulbright Scholar and Professor of International and Area Studies at University of Oklahoma, with an extensive background in global security, illicit trafficking, and international activism. Throughout her academic career, Dr. Grillo has published articles in the British Journal of Political Science, International Politics, Global Governance, and Contemporary Security Policy, among many others. She has co-edited and co-authored many book publications on global community and international security, including the extraordinary book, The International Arms Trade, with Rachel Stoll in 2009, which I can't recommend enough and which serves as a fantastic introduction to our topic today, a small arms system disarmament. Welcome, Dr. Grillo. Thank you so much for taking the time to speak with me today.
Thanks so much, Sebastian. Thanks for having me. Appreciate it.
I just wanted to start off with the general basic question of how you became to be interested in the arms trade.
Well, it's kind of an interesting story, I guess. I graduated with my bachelor's degree in 1990 when the Soviet Union was collapsing. The Cold War was ending. The fall of the Berlin Wall had happened in 1989. So it was a very precarious time. I had been studying Russian history and Soviet politics and the Russian language, and so I had an interest in that part of the world. And so watching it crumble, I was thinking, oh dear, what am I going to do now? Because I was going to graduate school for sure. And I wasn't sure exactly what I was going to study, but I knew it was going to be Soviet related or Russian related, former Soviet related. And so I had a professor that said, you know, they've got all of these weapons of mass destruction over there. They have a lot of nuclear, you know, obviously we knew we had a large nuclear arsenal. And we wonder what's going to happen to all of those weapons when this very large country, you know, falls apart and four new countries become nuclear weapon states, because Russia obviously inherited most of the Soviets' weapons, but so did Belarus, Ukraine, and Kazakhstan. And so I found that to be fascinating. I had an interest in human rights, and so my interest in the weaponry then became kind of a human security issue for me. And so I went to graduate school to study the former Soviet region, to study weapons proliferation, or the attempts to prevent the proliferation of nuclear weapons. I wrote a dissertation on Ukraine's decision to give up its nuclear weapons. So it wasn't until 1999, actually, that when I came to the University of Oklahoma, that somebody asked me to write a chapter in a book on conventional weapons. And I didn't really know much about conventional weaponry. I'd spent most of, you know, I spent all the 90s studying nuclear weapons. But I, you know, as a young assistant professor, I was like, oh, I need a book chapter. So I thought, okay, I'll take it. And I started a new project. And I then just immediately became much more fascinated by and interested in conventional weaponry and especially small arms and light weapons. So I kind of made this change from nuclear weapons control to what was happening with all of the small arms and light weapons that were basically flowing out of former Soviet, highly militarized former Soviet countries into Africa and other places where they were causing great destruction and massive loss of life, etc. And so that's really kind of how it happened. I'd always been interested in human rights and human security. I've always seen arms and armaments as an issue related to human security. And then I kind of made that shift from nuclear or weapons of mass destruction to small arms and light weapons because of the incredible problems that we were facing and continue to face today with a significant amount of weaponry flowing around the world, especially small arms and light weapons.
Yeah, that's so fascinating, especially, you know, when you think of the fact that when you say disarmament, people usually automatically switch to thinking of, you know, biological, chemical, and nuclear weapons, but that there is many organizations and branches of the United Nations itself dedicated to small arms disarmament as an entirely separate system.
That's right.
So I also wanted to ask you if you could just maybe give us a general history of arms control and when it was introduced on a widespread scale and how it works currently.
So arms control is really a 20th century phenomenon. Before then, we really saw arms manufacturers, you know, private entities that were really, you know, in control of developing weapons and selling them like any other commodity. Of course, the history of arms goes way back into around 850 AD when gunpowder basically was first discovered or invented in China to do fireworks. Basically, that's where gunpowder comes from. Somebody at some point decided to stick a ballistic on the end of a firework, and it, you know, lo and behold, you end up with the development of an actual, you know, weapon, firearm that you can hold and shoot people with. And so those began to be manufactured, you know, throughout Europe, eventually, of course, ended up in the United States. Lots and lots of gun manufacturers in the U.S. So it wasn't really until the 20th century, and in fact, around the First World War. I mean, the First World War, what was known as the Great War at the time, because there hadn't yet been a Second World War, was exceedingly destructive and deadly, more so than any war, of course, in the past. And although war is something that, you know, is kind of consistent throughout time, there's a lot of war that happens throughout human history. We get to a point where technology has created an environment where war has just become more and more deadly. And so you start seeing states, governments speaking with one another about how to manage the spread of weaponry, limit the types of weaponry that are available, can be used, that would be considered, and I'm doing air quotes here, legal in interstate warfare, in order to try to prevent war from being so deadly, right? So as technology has come, you know, once you hit the Industrial Revolution and you end up with all of this new technology that then allows you to kind of distance yourself further and further from your enemy, fly planes over them and drop bombs, shoot artillery, you know, be able to launch a ballistic missile, right? You've got all of this additional technology that removes you from that hand-to-hand combat that, you know, often mitigated war because you had to have people that would go into war and fight that kind of war. Well, with technology, you need perhaps not necessarily fewer people, but you need, you know, a lot of different types of skills that then kill a lot more people, and particularly a lot more civilians. There are a lot there's a lot more, I guess one might say, collateral damage as time has gone by. So humans, you know, the Red Cross became very interested and concerned in controlling weapons, but so did states and governments, and wanted to basically, you know, get their arms around private arms dealers, more or less, arms manufacturers and dealers, to establish more of a centralized control over the flow of weaponry, what gets made, where it gets sent, who has access to what. So that's kind of a longer view look of what you know, the history of arms and then arms control looks like. That's of course leading up to a whole century, the 20th century, of multiple arms control efforts. Attempts to limit the development of and spread of certain weapons, and particularly weapons of mass destruction, nuclear, chemical, biological weapons, as you earlier mentioned. So that it's a relative, so arms control, in other words, is a relatively recent phenomenon, and it really was sparked, if you will, by the First World War, but it was obviously heightened significantly after the Second World War and with the advent of weapons of mass destruction, that arms control became a major part of what governments tried to do for the latter part of the 20th century.
Thank you. Yeah, that's really fascinating. Thank you so much for that. You were talking about sort of how these how there became an emphasis on getting your hands on these weapons and where they go. How do those agreements and international arms legislation sort of happen?
Well, it's a great question, and it's definitely can be a bit of a mystery in terms of how these things get done. And there isn't always one like cookie cutter answer to how a particular arms control agreement gets done. But here are some of the ways in which we've established arms control agreements. So the United Nations certainly played a significant role in many arms control agreements, but it's also not necessarily the place where many of them have been successful. Most of these agreements have been, well, you know, bilateral. There were a lot of agreements between the United States and the Soviet Union, for example. So there were just, you know, attempts to work together to try to establish some parameters on what kind of weapons would kind of mitigate the likelihood that they would be going to war with one another, especially with weapons of mass destruction. But prior to that, you know, there were efforts at establishing arms registries. So there's a conventional arms registry, for example, at the United Nations. This is one area where they've established, you know, they have a whole unit for disarmament and arms control to try and establish a database that that, you know, states voluntarily provide whatever information they want to provide regarding their arms sales, so that there's some, there's more transparency. The idea being that there's, you know, if we know where weapons are going, then we're more knowledgeable about, you know, how to engage with one another and the extent to which, you know, our relations might be fraught with, you know, deadly warfare. So, you know, when you have to report where your weapons are going, perhaps you'll be more conscientious about where they're going, right? So, so there's that kind of effort. So registries, particularly for conventional weapons at the United Nations, that type of database, bilateral arrangements, particularly on the weapons of mass destruction side, but also some conventional weapons agreements, obviously, emerging in bilateral and in some multilateral situations. But then you also have, you know, the treaties that are signed, negotiated sometimes through the United Nations, sometimes not. But the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty, for example, that was signed in 1968 and came into force in 1970, that includes nearly every country on the planet that, you know, brought people together to say, look, weapons of mass destruction are just that. They are massively destructive. And we can't just let them kind of, you know, flow around the world willy-nilly. We have to, you know, be more conscientious about who gets them. And so that it brought to the table all of the nuclear weapon states, all of the nuclear power states, because if you have nuclear power, you can potentially have nuclear weapons, of course. It brought together people, you know, states and governments that had concerns about or had stockpiles of chemical or biological weapons to establish, for example, the Chemical Weapons Convention, the Biological Weapons Convention. So there was a lot of multilateral efforts along those lines to establish treaties. And from those treaties, we have, you know, certain organizations that pop up, the Wassenaar Arrangement, for example, that was, you know, meant to control dual-use technology, weapons and dual-use technology, the Australia Group, you know, countries that have bits and pieces of nuclear weapons, that have nuclear technology, that, you know, they may not have weaponry, but they have the technological capability to contribute to a weapon system. So they would come together and negotiate agreements to license, you know, publicly license components that would be contributing to weapon systems. So there's just, as you can see, there are just multiple ways in which governments have come together to establish, you know, bilateral agreements, multilateral agreements through the UN, outside of the UN, you know, in collaboration. I can't really say that there's a lot of unilateral weapons decision making, but there's some, you know, there have been a few countries that have kind of unilaterally decided we're not going to have this type of weapon system, or, you know, seek weapons of mass destruction, or whatever the case may be. But I want to be sure to mention and the importance of and the role of, particularly in the latter part of the 20th century and into the 21st century now, the role of non-governmental organizations and individuals, particularly high-profile individuals, people that, you know, that are celebrity, for example. The landmine ban, right, had a huge boost because people like Princess Diana was, you know, out visiting minefields and was supporting the work of the international campaign to ban landmines, which was a arms control agreement that was actually taken out of the UN, was basically driven by thousands of non-governmental organizations working in collaboration with one another to get governments to sign on to a landmine ban.
Wow.
Right. So that is kind of the newer days of arms control, right? You have the Cluster Munitions Coalition that was able to get countries to sign on to an agreement to stop using cluster munitions. You have an International Action Network on Small Arms and Light Weapons, a collection of non-governmental organizations and individuals, people like you and me, that, you know, want to try to limit the spread of small arms and light weapons. So now we see a whole plethora, basically, of arms control activities going on. You know, states and governments are still central to this because states and governments obviously are, you know, they have the monopoly on force largely, and they are the ones that, you know, produce and or license to produce the world's weapons, and are the ones that often are engaged in the sales, and so they are critical to the conversation and have been more reluctant. But non-governmental organizations have been putting a lot of pressure, using a lot of shame tactics, if you will, highlighting transparency, etc., to try to bring governments to the table. So that's kind of a long, answer to your question, but it's a complicated process. Arms control, it can be very touchy and very difficult, and take years and years and years to do, to get to an agreement, and there might be multiple different actors that are involved in the process.
That's really interesting. Yeah, that makes sense, and that's interesting to know about the role of non-governmental organizations, particularly now. So, you know, in terms of what they've achieved, sort of what have they achieved currently in terms of international arms legislation? I know you're mentioning something about, you know, cluster munitions as well as landmines, but what international arms legislation is in place currently? If I'm, you know, a private organization that wants to sell or buy arms, what's the role, or internationally, what is the role of those the international arms legislation and restrictions in that, and just what's your own opinion on its strengths and weaknesses? What could be done better? What could be done worse?
Well, I'll just use the United States as an example. If you're a weapons producer in the United States, defense contractor, somebody who's producing weaponry, right? Depending on what you're producing and what you're trying to sell and to whom, there is a process through which you have to, seek approval from the government. Multiple agencies within the government are involved in licensing, in reviewing licenses, and just, you know, making sure that weapons production and export are, you know, going to serve basically the interests of the United States government. And most countries around the world have a similar problem. They'll all look different, basically. But there will be control measures, is what we call them. Control measures in place, arms control measures in place, export control measures in place, so that weapons that are being produced, that there's kind of awareness about that, and then you know where they're going and to whom they're being sold. Particularly when there's kind of government to government sales or private entity to government sales. So there are a lot of restrictions and a lot of licensing requirements in order to do that. Now, having said all that, some of the weaknesses, will be that no control system is going to be foolproof, right? So you, there's always a way to circumvent, and we see that happen a lot. And particularly when resources, when some governments don't have the kinds of resources that are needed in order to have a really robust control system, you know, then you've got some weaknesses in the system, and weapons can find them their way to bad actors, I guess, if we want to call them that. I use that word loosely and in general, because obviously one person's bad actor is not so much, you know, another person's bad actor. But nonetheless, the whole point is that, you know, there are kind of eyeballs on it, oversight of weapons production and weapons flows. Now, let's be very clear that this has to do with weapons sales, you know, large weapons. Certainly, there are fewer restrictions clearly on small arms. And that is largely thanks to the gun lobby, right? You can't just easily go out and buy a tank. You know, you can't go buy, you know, a large piece of artillery, but you can buy military style weapons, rifles, handguns, of course, of all sorts, as a civilian. In fact, most of the world's weapons are in the hands of civilians and not in the hands of militaries and police forces around the world. So that's kind of where you end up having to draw the line in terms of there being, you know, rather stringent arms production, sales, export controls. Now, on the weapons of mass destruction side, it's a whole different story, right? You're talking that there are a lot of restrictions and a lot of things going on that side that, you know, the government is quite heavy-handed in that area. And even though we tend to talk about, you know, missing fissile material or loose nukes and, you know, the suitcase bombs and things like that, and the concerns about fissile material kind of flowing to terrorist organizations, that's certainly something the government's watching. It's certainly, you know, there are lots of controls and checks. For example, the International Atomic Energy Agency out there making sure that, you know, places that are producing fissile material through nuclear power plants, for example, are under, you know, strong controls and that there's a lot of accountability. But on the conventional weapon side, on the large gun side, you know, you still have perhaps more controls and more checks and balances. But on the small arms side, you really don't. And as I mentioned, the gun lobby, gun rights advocates are really strong in this area. They do not want to see many, if any, barriers to having access to small arms and light weapons. And so we really do have, when we talk about arms control, we really do have to have that distinction in mind. And that is critical then to understanding, like, how do we go about, you know, controlling smaller weapons, you know, and what are the implications of that if you do or don't. That opens the whole, you know, gate, I guess, if you will, to discussions about, you know, domestic gun control and then the ways in which legally produced and procured weapons end up, right, in an illicit market. So I'm not fully sure that answered all of your question, but yeah, that's kind of the gist, I guess, of arms control, kind of what it looks like and what some of the strengths and weaknesses might be.
Yeah, thank you. That's a really interesting insight. You mentioned about how, you know, there's differences between, you know, military use and civilian use, and I actually I'm not entirely sure I knew that, you know, more guns were in the hands of civilians than military uses. So basically, in terms of, you mentioned, you know, the hoops and the restrictions that are there for the arms trade just about everywhere, you were saying, how are the restrictions different if, you know, I'm selling to civilians or a civilian buying versus, you know, a military maybe licensing contractors to create to create weapons for the army versus a producer that is intentionally selling to civilians or selling to government contractors? How do those different worlds look? You know, where is the demand mostly? And basically, what are the different restrictions there?
Well, I'm not entirely sure if I can give you a lot of detail here, but let me just see if I can answer that question in general. I mean, when you're talking about weapons for militaries and law enforcement agencies, obviously you have a significant role for the state, for governments. They procure those weapons. They have budgets for them. They work with private industry, typically, at least in the United States and in Europe and in most places, not necessarily in China. You know, China, Russia, for example, your weapons industry isn't really privatized as it is in much of the rest of the world. So it's still very state controlled, and they have a lot more oversight and control over what's produced and where it goes and to whom. Where in I guess, again, air quoting kind of the Western world, you know, the where, you know, liberal economics rules, you know, our world.
Yeah.
And we, you know, live in a capitalist world system, you know, weapons producers are private entities, and they contract with governments to produce weapons for militaries and law enforcement agencies. And so, you know, then you've got, you know, government contractors, basically, you know, the people that work in, you know, the Department of Defense, et cetera, that go out there, and I can't really say what all the details are, but basically they work with the private industry to sign contracts, whether it's Boeing or whatever, you know, military industrial member of the military industrial complex we're talking about, you know, will have a contract to produce those weapons. Now, those same companies, you know, that produce, let's say, small arms and light weapons, that will sign contracts with governments and states to produce their weaponry, will also provide weapons that can be purchased by civilians. You know, people like you and me, when we walk into a Walmart or, you know, any kind of gun shop, we can buy, you know, the gun firearms that are available through those vendors. You can buy them at gun shows. You can buy them online. You can, you know, there's a huge array of places where if you want to procure a gun, you can procure a gun legally. There are also many, many ways in which you can procure a gun illegally and illicitly. So that's the hard part, right? And a lot of people that work in the gun control, arms control areas, you know, know and understand that we're not dealing with hardware that can be banned necessarily easily, at least as a whole class. You know, it's like you're not going to ban all firearms or whatever, because you know, military forces and police and law enforcement agencies do need to have some access to these weapons. And then, of course, you know, so do civilians in many cases. And of course, there's the recreational part of firearm use as well. So people that hunt and, you know, just shoot at targets or whatever as a form of recreation. So at the end of the day, basically, they're a commodity that are produced by private entities and that are licensed to do so on behalf of the government if they have a government contract, and then they can sell them in various ways to private individuals, you know, through hopefully legal channels. Now, I'm doing kind of air quotes on legal channels, but quite frankly, the legal channels are quite broad. I mean, we don't have a lot of restrictions on the types of weapons that we can buy, the number that we can buy. You can go into Walmart and buy all their weapons if you want. I could go buy them all today, take my credit card and go buy all the weapons in Walmart. There's no real restriction on like how many I can buy, how many bullets I can buy, right? And so that's where you start opening the door to, should we really be able to, like, you know, go clean out the Walmart today of all of their weapons? You know, we're all the Walmarts in my town. I can go to every Walmart today and buy all of the weapons in my town. You know, that's when people start to say, well, where is the line here? You know, and then it's like, then there, you bring into this conversation a lot of things like background checks and waiting periods and all of the things that, again, gun lobbies and gun rights advocates try to prevent too many of these things, because they believe that any restriction on being able to buy a firearm is problematic, and that it's, in their words, kind of a slippery slope, you know, that once you start restricting, that you just keep restricting. And so they work really, really hard to, you know, install any kind of restrictions, whereas gun control advocates are clearly looking at the data of, you know, firearm usage and accidents, deaths by suicide, homicides, et cetera, and saying, you know, this is not something that we should just easily, you know, let anyone have. And particularly when you bring into, you know, the conversation issues with people that perhaps are suffering from a mental illness, should they have access to a firearm because they're a danger to themselves and others, et cetera, right? So this becomes quite messy when you get down to that level. In other words, of like how it looks, it's quite messy. But at the same time, it's also right now, quite frankly, relatively simple. And that is producers produce weapons. They sell them to either directly to citizens or through middle companies like Walmart or other types of gun, you know, gun providers out there, vendors that offer firearms, and you know, and then hope that the you know, people that are buying them are going to, you know, use them in the, I guess, again, air quoting, kind of proper and appropriate ways, you know. So again, that's kind of a, I'm a professor, so you asked me to profess here, and I'm professing what I know about these things. But hopefully that answered your question anyway on like, you know, how these things look from like the government, kind of government sales and what governments do versus kind of like what private citizens and individuals do.
Yeah, that definitely answered my question. Thank you. Feel free to profess. you had mentioned, I think in general, we've sort of been talking about, you know, both the politics in the United States and also through the lens of what is going on internationally with small arms legislation, how, you know, the United States is independent, because I think we often talk about it in the United States as a problem that's independent of, you know, a more global network of small arms and small arms disarmament. How is the United States similar or different to other countries? And in general, how do these individual roles like play out in terms of these international as well as legislations?
So interestingly, you know, on one level, the United States has one of the most strict gun production, gun sales, you know, weapons procurement processes in the world than anybody else in the world. I mean, there's a whole bureaucracy set up in the U.S. government to control the flow of weapons, particularly large weapons and certainly weapons of mass destruction. So on the one hand, you know, on the government side, there's a significant amount of you know, attention, bureaucracy, and control of these weapons. And I would say more so than many, many other governments. Now West European governments and weapons producers like the UK and France, for example, Germany, you know, European countries do this. They also have extensive control systems and control measures in place, what we call export control and licensing procedures. But the United States is, you know, it like this is our baby. That's what we've promoted this sort of thing. Now, when it comes to the civilian side and, you know, access to small arms, light weapons, even military style weaponry, you know, we also are like one of the least likely to control access to weapons. So we've got kind of like two separate roles that we're playing here as a major kind of weapons control advocate, arms control advocate, and major player in the world on arms control, at least historically speaking. But let's be clear, the United States sells more weapons around the world than anybody else in the world. I mean, like by far.
Yeah.
Like we have the corner on the market, right? I mean, the close Russia, China, you know, they have just a sliver compared to what the United States has. We dominate the global market on arms sales. But that, having said that, so it's not so much that we're like careful necessarily, again, air quotes, of where we sell. It's just that there's a significant process, right? And it's both a political process and a policy process and a procedural, you know, like there are lots of steps, et cetera.
That's so interesting.
Yeah. So that's important, I think, to understand on the one hand. On the other hand, we have relatively fewer restrictions when you compare us to countries like France and the UK and et cetera, and certainly China and Russia. I mean, I lived in China for a while. It's illegal for Chinese citizens to own weapons. You know, many countries around the world, it's illegal for their citizens to own weapons. There are some countries where every citizen, like Switzerland, for example, you know, where every house is armed. You know, that's, so there's, you know, in terms of guns per capita, you know, there are other countries that rival the United States, but very, very few, very few. And the restrictions on how you procure them, what you can do with them, are much greater in other places than in the United States. So it's kind of, it's a paradox in many ways in my mind. And it's, and I don't want to make it sound like I'm an expert on US gun control, because I'm really not. I've spent most of my time on the international arms trade side of things, on looking at the flows of weapons internationally. I'm not as well versed on the gun control, that domestic gun control side, other than just being a concerned citizen and somebody that pays attention to gun control policy. But it does seem quite apparent that we have fewer restrictions in place on the civilian possession side than most countries, but a heavier load when it comes to, you know, licensing and procuring and et cetera on the government to government
for exportation
side.
As well, or is that specifically just for contracting?
For export. Yeah,
gotcha.
For export.
Mm-hmm. So back to the question of, you know, exportation and manufacturers. Are arms manufacturers liable for selling to the wrong people? And how does that work? Or the wrong people, obviously, in air quotes. People who, I guess you could say people who perpetrate crimes against humanity. But in general, you know, the idea of wrong people. And just in general, how do these militant groups or governments acquire dangerous weapons? And what does the, I'm guessing that that's related to the illicit arms trade. And what does that illicit arms trade look like? Like, where do those guns get made? And where are they coming from?
So again, an excellent question, hard to answer, largely because what we know about the illicit trade is limited, because obviously it's illicit and therefore secret and not very transparent for a reason. I've spent years studying the illicit arms, you know, market and trade. There are some very good data collectors out there, Small Arms Survey, for example. You know, others that are working really hard to try to bring some transparency to the illicit arms market, but it is tough. It's really hard to know exactly how many weapons, you know, are in circulation in a legal way versus, you know, are in circulation in the illicit market. But what we do know is that many people procure weapons outside of legal channels, right? And your part of your question had to do with like militant groups or, you know, paramilitaries, people that are, you know, terrorist organizations, criminal organizations, et cetera, are obviously procuring weapons. And, you know, a lot of those weapons were perhaps produced and introduced into the market legally. You know, in fact, most of the weapons that end up in an illicit market were produced and procured in some way, shape, or form legally, but then end up either through theft or diversion, you know, or some sort of nefarious gun running ends up in the hands of, you know, people that necessarily, you know, that are going to engage in, I think, as you mentioned, war crimes or genocide or, you know, civil war, whatever the case may be. This is, you know, one of the things that we're concerned about. Now, there have been lots of efforts at the international level to try and deal with illicit trafficking. In fact, globally, it's illicit trafficking of weapons that gets most attention. So even in the arms trade treaty, right, we have an arms trade treaty now, global arms trade treaty, you know, it was watered down to the extent that really there's just a major, you know, kind of emphasis on illicit trafficking.
Yeah.
Right. So there's not a lot of international regulation on the legal side, right? Legal sales.
And that's just because the illicit arms trade is something that everyone can get behind is
that. Exactly. It is the lowest common denominator, right? Even gun rights people are, you know, kind of on that is common ground for everyone where, nobody wants to see weapons moving around, you know, in an illicit way, in an illegal way and being used, you know, to really, really harm people. But the problem is that there's a connection between the legal
and the illegal
movement and the illegal side. And if you don't do so, in other words, if you don't do something about the legal side, it's really hard to fight the illegal side, right? It's really hard to do something about illicit trafficking if you're not really paying attention to how many weapons are being produced and sold and to whom on the legal side, right? So you have to, they're connected and inextricably connected. And so that's what makes, you know, a lot of the agreements kind of, you know, paper tigers, if you will, because they're just a bunch of words about, we don't want illicit trafficking to happen. Well, you know, no duh. How are we going to police that? How are we going to know, you know, how are we going to trace that back? I mean, your original question ended up with taking responsibility Sorry, let me say that again. Your original question had to do with taking responsibility. So that requires the ability to be able to trace weapons back to their source, right? Where did they come from? Where did they move from a legal market into an illicit market, and who did that? Who provided the weapons, you know? And can we identify them? And then how do you go about holding them accountable? Right. That is a significant problem. So then you start thinking, okay, we need marking and tracing. We need all weapons that are produced to be marked so that they can be traced, you know, back to their source. But then the problem becomes this: somebody who legally produces and marks their weapons, and then it goes off, and then somebody diverts them. Should you hold, the original producer, you know, responsible for something that they, you know, didn't have anything to do with necessarily, other than the fact that they produced the thing that then, you know, caused harm? So this is you can even bring this down to like just the individual level, right? That somebody walks into a Walmart, buys a gun, goes out, you know, and shoots a bunch of people, you know, in a movie theater. Is Walmart responsible? Is the producer of that gun, you know, Smith & Wesson or whoever, you know, are they responsible? Who's responsible, right, for the ultimate crime? Now, of course, gun rights advocates are like, well, the person that pulled the trigger is responsible because it's guns. Guns don't kill people. People kill people, right? That's their famous phrase, is that, guns are just a thing, but they have to, you know, somebody has to pull the trigger. And so this becomes a really, really tricky debate and difficult to get around, except for the fact that we do hold automobile manufacturers responsible if they provide something that, you know, actually causes harm. Airline industry, we hold them responsible if, you know, they produce an airplane, let's say a 737 MAX 8 that, you know, crashes, two major crashes, 5 months apart, we hold them responsible. Their planes get grounded, people cancel their orders. So, you know, there is precedence for the manufacturers of these things to be held accountable. But right now, they're only held accountable if, like, you buy a defective item. Like, if you buy a gun and you shoot it and it blows up in your face and you become injured, then you can, you know, go after the producer of that gun. But there really is no way to hold, you know, either the producer of the gun responsible if a criminal gets a hold of it and, you know, murders somebody. Just like it's really hard to hold, let's say, you know, gun runner X, Y, or Z, or government X, Y, or Z that diverts weapons and runs them off into the hands of, you know, the Taliban or Al-Qaeda or, you know, militant group in whatever, you know, country. So I think there are some examples. There's some famous, people like Victor Boot, for example, is a really famous, you know, gun runner, used to be Soviet military leader, used all of his contacts when the Soviet Union collapsed to divert a lot of weapons from Soviet arsenals to those, you know, militants in various places that wanted and needed, you know, for their purposes, those weapons. He was a fugitive for quite some time before he was eventually arrested and now remains in jail. But you know, it's like that, that's rare. You know, those are really rare circumstances. And then it's just the middle person, right? You're not necessarily holding accountable the governments that produce the weapons to begin with, the gun manufacturer who, you know, made the guns to begin with, right? You're holding the person who, did the gun running or smuggling responsible. And again, that's really, really hard to do ultimately.
Yeah, that is so interesting. Yeah. So I think, we're approaching the end of the questions that I'd prepared for you. But before we go, I just have one last question, which is, for my generation, is there anything you would want young people to know or consider for the future of small arms trade and disarmament that, they're not thinking about, or just what do you think should be added to the conversation for young people?
Well, I think clearly young people have seen, unfortunately, way too much gun violence. We've had the past 20 or so years of multiple, mass shootings in schools. Mass shootings in places where young people gather, whether it's concerts or nightclubs or what have you. Mass shootings are a very American phenomenon, by and large. And of course, we have to be careful when we say mass shootings. Technically, the term mass shooting is any one incident where four or more people have been killed in one location. And basically, quite frankly, they happen every day in the United States. They happen every day, four or more people in one gathering being shot every day in the United States, right? So, I mean, this is kind of unheard of, right, in other parts of the world. You just don't see that kind of gun culture, gun use, gun violence. So it is a critical issue for young people. It does affect your well-being. College campuses, for example, are rethinking, their rules about allowing students to be armed or professors to be armed. High schools, elementary schools, having armed guards, arming teachers, exacerbating, right? More or less exacerbating, in my opinion, exacerbating. The answer to violence is not necessarily more violence, right? The capability to engage in violence. So, really digging into this issue is critical. But to me, the ultimate obstacle to real legit conversations about gun control and how we minimize gun violence, particularly in the United States, is the extensive and very powerful and well-funded opposition of the gun rights lobby. And that is something that's really, I think young people have to really pay attention to the politics here. You have to pay attention to the fact that organizations like the NRA and perhaps even, there are lots of gun rights organizations. The NRA is kind of like the most well-known, the National Rifle Association, but there are lots of gun rights organizations, some that are even way more conservative than the NRA, but they are very engaged in our political process. They give a lot of money to our political candidates. There's a lot of gun money in our politics. There's a huge military-industrial complex that produces weapons of all sorts, and they have a huge role to play in our politics. So it's not enough to even just say to young people today, just go out and vote and participate in your political process. That is like the bare minimum, right? The bare minimum is you need to be registering to vote, you need to be voting, you need to be paying attention to your political races and the policies that people stand for. But there's a whole political reform process that needs to be a part of the conversation. And I've been saying this for a long time in the college classroom. I've been teaching in college classrooms for 30 years and as a graduate student and then as a professor, is that we have really got to take seriously the connection between money and politics and the special interest that, because these gun rights advocates have an outsized, heavy presence in our political process. And it's hard to combat that. It really is. It's very difficult to do. There are a lot of great gun control advocates and gun control organizations out there doing amazing work. It's tough. It's hard work, but they often get targeted literally. I mean, like literally and figuratively targeted for the work that they're doing. You know, we really need to be pressing our government to do more research on gun control or gun violence issues as a public health crisis. It's a public health crisis. It's not just a matter of, you know, crime. It's public health.
Yeah.
It has an effect on, you know, our public health industry, on our economic development, on education, on everything. And so young people really, in my opinion, yeah, all people, but certainly young people, because young people are, I think, are, you know, Generation Z, much more access to information, has much more access to data, and is much more likely to be organized around these issues. But it's not just the issue, it's the political process, and the policy process that is affecting the ultimate outcome on this issue. So really engaging in that is not a luxury anymore, you know, just an aside, a hobby to say, I'm just going to get involved, you know, politics is my hobby, or, you know, paying attention to policy is a hobby. No, it's, you have to,
yeah,
to be really super aware of and engaged on this issue.
Yeah. Well, that's a fascinating answer. And I think it's something we should all probably consider more. Thank you so much for coming on the podcast.
Yeah.
It was so much fun.
Yeah, great. Well, thank you, Sebastian. I wish you the best of luck. And thank you for doing the podcast. This is such a great thing. I love the title, Bullet Points. That's really awesome. You're doing great work. So keep it up.
Thank you so much. Yeah, thank you for meeting with me today. Thank you.
Thanks.
Bye.